You are listening to the Political Periscope, a weekly podcast brought to you by Radio WNET. Interviews on international politics, security, geopolitics, economy, and more. Every Thursday at 7 p.m.
Today's guest of the Political Periscope is Nandi Mazingo, the chairperson of the Ova Herero Genocide Foundation from Namibia.
Political Periscope.
I think in Poland only a bunch of people ever heard, maybe some specialists, of the genocide of Ova Herero people. Can you explain a bit, tell something?
Yes, the genocide of Ova Herero and Nama people took place between 1904 and 1907. So it is the first genocide of the 20th century. And like many parts of the world, the Germans went to hunt out for land so that they can settle their populations there because they had a crisis. German cities were overflowing. So they went out around the world to look for colonies and specifically spaces where they can relocate German settlers to as a second home away from Germany. In Africa, Germany had about 4 or 5 colonies. Namibia, present-day Namibia, it used to be called Southwest Africa, and when they took over, they changed it to German Southwest Africa. There was Togo, there was Cameroon, there was Tanzania. But the territory that is today Namibia, which then was German Southwest Africa, was really the crown in their colonies setting. It is Namibia that they chose because of its weather. You know, it's not like in the tropical of the Cameroons where people could get diseases and so forth. So they found the climatic condition in Namibia to be hospitable, to be one where they can relocate a population to. Unfortunately, in that space, the Ova Herero and Nama people have made it their home for more than 1,000 years. And so they are the people who had to be killed to give way for the Germans actually to settle there. And that is why after settling there for a while, I mean, after coming in, of course, it was not an easy coming in where they said, hello, can we live amongst you? It was, you know, some tactics of cheating people out of their land, raping Herero women, you know, coming with fake deals. Like they would come in like merchandise traders, people who are selling goods, and you'll be given these goods on credit. And then later on, if you want to pay for if you want to settle your debt, you'll be told, no, it cannot be paid in money. It has to be paid in land or your cattle. You know, this went on for a while, and our people got to a point where they could not take this anymore, and so they decided to take up arms, to rebel, to resist. And of course, that genocide and the whole happenings around it is very much linked to what would take place later on in Nazi Germany. The concentration camps, the beheading of people, cutting off people's heads to experiment on them, to check that these people are actually inferior to the white Aryan race. All of these things started in Namibia. I'm sitting in Warsaw, Poland, and it is in Poland where we have Auschwitz, you know, the death camp. That idea was experimented in Namibia. There was a place called Shark Island where prisoners of war were rounded up, and because it's an island, and then they would be underfed, they would be worked to death, and then those who are weak to walk or do anything, they would just be dumped into the ocean to turn them into food for shark fish. So that is what happened there. And also the glaring similarities and the link between that genocide and the Third Reich, the crimes of the Nazi. For instance, the first man who was dispatched to German Southwest Africa as a colony of Germany after the Berlin Conference of 1885, his name was Heinrich Goering. Now, Heinrich Goering is the father of Hermann Goering, who was the right-hand man of Hitler. And so many other men of his generation actually took part in the campaigns for killing Ova Herero people and driving them off the land. that they have known as their home for a very long time, simply because the Germans, as educated by many racist scholars like geographers Friedrich Ratzel and many others, who argued that Germany had a right to go and find this Lebensraum, or the idea of a living space for, you know, for the supreme Aryan race. But really, to come back to the history, in 1904, our people took up arms. That was the Hereros. And they scored some victories. Of course, they were very specific during that war to say women and children should not even be touched. They had a business with the German men who were taking their land, who were raping their women and stealing their cattle and all of this. So after a while, they thought they had really sent the message to the Germans that what they are doing is not tolerable. In the meanwhile, they thought, you know, as wars were fought during that time, you fight and you move on, you make truce, you move on. What they did not know is that the Germans were actually reinforcing week after week. There was a ship docking at the port of Swakopmund, bringing in German men. There was an intense campaign in Germany against the Herero people to say they are bloodthirsty people who had killed and murdered German women and children. All lies fabricated to really, you know, create a hype around this thing and recruit many German young boys, you know, to go to Southwest Africa and kill the Hereros. And at that point, they had also withdrawn the German commander, Theodor Ludwein, and they had replaced him with a man who was known for brutalities, who had participated in the quelling of the China Boxing Revolution, but also a revolution, a rebellion that had taken place in East Africa in the German colonial holdings of Tanzania and Zanzibar, then known as Tanganyika. So that man is General Lothar von Troda, and he came to Namibia to kill the Herero people. He came already armed with an extermination order which had been sanctioned by the Kaiser, the Kaiser Wilhelm, the ruler of Germany, to kill Hereros and to actually banish or to expel those who survives out of what they called German land. So that is what they did in 1904 on the 2nd of October, the first extermination order against the Herero, which was actually the first time the intention to kill a whole people was committed to paper. Ever before that moment, different rulers, however ruthless and whatever they were and crazy in their ideas, they had never committed that to paper. But Lothar von Troda was the first man to write it down to say, my intention is to destroy the whole Herero nation and to expel those who survived, even children and women, everything was to be shot dead. The idea is really to kill all of these people and take all their land and cattle, because in Southern Africa, of a Herero would be your version of the Maasai's in East Africa, because we are cattle herders. You know, it's just our pride and means of subsistence is what we live off. Our cattle is really the center of a Herero life. So in 1904, that extermination order was issued. Hereros were pursued, driven into the dry Kalahari Sands, which is a desert that runs into Botswana. The Germans would sit guard at water wells to make sure that Hereros who have taken refuge in the field would not come and drink water from those wells. They would poison the wells. And so 80% of the Herero were actually destroyed, of the Herero nation. 80%, which is 80,000 out of 100,000 people strong at that time, were killed. Watching and observing from a bit of a distance what was happening to their northern neighbors, the Nama people also decided, because they knew it was an open secret, and the Germans were saying it to everybody, that once they are done with the Hereros, they would also have to wipe out the Namas, because it was the adjacent land to the land of the Hereros. So the Namas knew that, and they also took up arms in October 1904. Unfortunately, they could not have, they didn't do it at a time where they would have formed a formidable front against the Germans. By the time they did it, the Hereros had already been militarily neutralized. They had already been killed. And so when that happened, the Germans also issued an extermination order against the Namas on the 25th of April 1905. But the Namas, of course, they were savvy in guerrilla warfare, and so they could hold out the Germans for about 3 more years to 1907. The Germans could not really declare victory over them because the Namas would hit and run, you know, disrupt their supplies, their reinforcements, hit their military installations and so forth. And so that took a while, and until 1907, with the conniving of the church, the missionaries, they were the people who were recruited to go out into the field and find our people who had taken refuge, who were staying away from these Germans, to come in to the cities on the pretext, on the premise of a lie that the Kaiser had issued a pardon against. I mean, they were forgiven, they could come back. But on arrival into all this, the missionaries had holding cells or whatever this way, where the people would be kept, given good food. Initially, you would be given good food so that you can go back into the field and tell others to also come home. And it is once the missionaries were convinced that you have now amassed in good numbers, then they will give a signal to the troopers to come and collect you. And on collection, you were not taken back to your house, but rather you were taken to concentration camps. And it is in those concentration camps, because at this point the Germans had realized that the idea of extermination was impossible. You know, you just can't kill all people, also many people who are in their own space that you don't really know so well. They were just, it's just not possible. But they also realized that they needed labor for the colonial economy. So then the idea was to separate those whom they deemed as workable from those whom they deemed as unworkable. Those who were deemed as unworkable had to be taken into those camps and really to be starved to death, because they were of no use to the colonial economy. But those who were deemed workable, largely the hereros who are of a larger physique, they had to be worked, really, like to work in the factories or whatever, you know, the industries that the Germans were setting up. But the Namas, who are generally a petite people, like of a smaller physique, they had to be kept in the camps and to be understaffed, I mean, underfed and undernourished, so that nature would take its course. And there were about four or so concentration camps that were ran in the central of the country, but there was a special one that initially started off as a camp of Herero people who were taken to the southern part, deep into a Nama area, to work on a railway line. But soon that camp was actually turned into what is now known as the first death camp of the Germans in the 20th century. And it is on that camp where many Herero and Nama lives were lost. People were just, it is there where also those who were dying on a daily basis, 100, 200 of them, heads would just be shipped off to Europe to be apparently experimented on. Medical centers would just file in to say, look, we need heads to study what. These guys would say, no problem, we have many of them. They would just keep shipping them. I'm sorry, and it is the wives, it is the children of those who have died, who had to sit there and take off the hair, boil these heads, take off the skin, and package these scars of their family members for these pseudo scientific experiments that were to be carried out, you know, in here in Europe. And those scars continue to sit here in Europe.
Have Germany ever recognized the genocide? Did they even say sorry, not speaking about some reparations?
No, Germany continues to play games around these things. It of course, it was a condition that Germany comes to terms with its racist, genocidal and brutal past for it to be admitted into the club of civilized nations. It was a condition post the 1945, you know, whole mess of the Hitler regime, of the Third Reich. So, and since then they have built this image of a modern, tolerant, moral authority, you know, country that does not invest in military, does not believe in militarism, you know, that is so tolerant of all things extreme. But that is really just a charade. It's a lie, because They have, yes, recognized the crimes of the Third Reich. They had gone to some extent to make right with the crimes of that era insofar as our Jewish brothers and sisters are concerned. But they continue to deny our crimes. They, in fact, in a process wherein they deliberately chose to avoid talking direct to us, but talking to us through the proxy, through the Namibian government, which I'm sure through their own intelligence knows is not a government that is sourced from people from our communities because of the genocide. And now, you know, Namibia being a democracy and so being a game of numbers, we are an insignificant minority and other groupings are now the majority, and so they are controlling the state, they are in government. The Germans knew very well that those who are in government couldn't care less about our struggle. So, but in the argument of state sovereignty, they are talking to the Namibian government. And of course, recently there was after 7 years of negotiation between the two governments, there was an understanding that was initialized. And in that understanding, Germany has said, and this is what is fooling those who don't read well and know the language proper. Germany have said they now recognize that the events of that time is a genocide from today's perspective. Now, those who don't read the language very well would say Germany has now finally admitted guilt. No, it hasn't. What Germany says, not only in that text, but also in papers that they had filed in the courts, because we had filed a lawsuit in America. We are now, as I speak to you, also having a case in Namibia, in the Namibian courts against the Namibian government for having excluded us from talks that essentially are about us, or primarily, not essentially, are about us. Germany says, at the time of committing those atrocities, we were savages. We were not protected by any civilized or any law that protects civilized nations, because this was at the turn of the last century. But they are saying now, because of numerous international instruments that have come into being, we have assumed civilized rights. We are now people that must be protected by these instruments. Therefore, if you look at those events from today's perspectives, they can be termed a genocide, but at the time of commissioning it and executing it, it was not a genocide. What does that say? It says I'm not guilty, because at the time of doing it, there was no law that forbade me from doing it. But they are lying also, we know. Because, for instance, the 1884 Berlin Conference and the 1900 agreement of that conference, it forbade all new colonial powers from mistreating the natives. Their responsibility was that they go into these colonies and they look after those natives. These are some of the languages themselves that they built into that. So Germany has not, they have not spoken to us directly. We know that in 2004, at the occasion of the centenary commemoration of the genocide, there was a German Minister of Economic Cooperation, a certain Madame Heidemarie Zolok, or something like that. She graced our occasion with her presence, and I think she got a bit just too weak, and she broke down and started crying and offered an apology, a heartfelt apology. And we thought, here we are, we have arrived at the moment. But as soon as she touched down in Germany, her apology was disowned. It was said it was her own madness, and she offered that in her own capacity, and that frankly was the last we had of her. That really signaled the end of her political career, because the Germans want to present it, it's the whole thing, it's a fake thing to show the world or to look like you are doing something, yet you are not doing anything, because they know that if you admit guilt to the crime of genocide, there is already a defined penalty for genocide. And genocide essentially, yes, it is a construct that has political meanings, that has moral meaning, but essentially, genocide is a legal construct. It is a legal, it's a crime. So if you are guilty of a crime, there is already a defined penalty in law, and that penalty is reparation. It's not negotiable. And that is why Germany is always running around and avoiding admitting guilt, avoiding talking to genocide, avoiding talking to reparation, and saying their discussion with us is only in political and moral terms, is what they can offer and that kind of thing, you know.
And that's what your foundation is doing. It's trying to get Germans to admit the genocide and to pay reparations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have had a concerted campaign over many years. Of course, we filed lawsuits. Some would say our lawsuits, for instance, those that we filed in America, they would say they didn't yield anything. But we say those lawsuits, each one of them actually served its purpose because they rose the profile of this story. Not very many people knew. Germany itself got embarrassed because so many people started talking about this because they had created this fake image again of a nation that has come to terms with its history. People began asking questions. Germany's image globally took a dent, and they couldn't afford that. That is why they offered to talk. But still, this talking had to be offered to somebody else to speak on our behalf. So what we have done, around 2006, we have gone to our own parliament. We have asked our parliament to adopt a position, a motion that says, number one, what Germany has done is a genocide, and so there must be work done. The Namibian state must work towards demanding or extracting that admission from Germany. Secondly, that Germany must also pay reparation to us, you know, as victims of genocide, which is a crime against humanity. There are many instruments, the UN Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. They do that. So, of course, Germany now, with the connivance of our own government, which in our view really just wants money out of this thing, not really real justice for us, you know, they've been avoiding that. They've now talked, now there's an agreement that is just talking of projects to be funded through the government, which of course we have rejected. So our work as a foundation is to raise awareness around this issue, because we know that especially right here in Europe, not very many people know about our history. So our work is about raising that awareness, specifically in Germany, because we believe that it is the German populace who has the leverage to be able to change the trajectory of their own government, because they are the voters, you know. If they can hold their government to account, if I can talk to a young child in school somewhere, maybe when that child grows up and becomes a policymaker, he will see things differently. You know, so it is on such small things that we are pinning our hope. We are raising awareness, we are doing advocacy work amongst politicians, but we are also advising our leadership on our litigation efforts, you know, because we are fighting on many fronts. We are talking to the United Nations, for instance. Recently, there is a report, a damning report that was released by 8 UN rapporteurs specialized in different areas of intervention, from women's rights to the participation of indigenous people in processes that are aimed at redressing, you know, historical wrongs. All of those things, you know, we are talking about all of those things, and we are trying to make sure that Germany at one point just does they just have to do the right thing. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So. It is the UN rapporteurs, for instance, they have come back to talk about the wrongs, I mean, or the violation of our rights. All of these things, these are all work of us as technical people advising our leadership, you know. But we believe that even though the Germans are refusing to listen today, more than 10 years ago we were told they will never come to the court. They did. More than 10 years ago we were told they will never talk. They are talking. You know, even though they are talking to the wrong person. So we see these little steps as progress in a long-haul struggle that we are prepared to stay at. And because we believe we are on the right side of history, we are on the right side of the law, of justice and truth, we will never, never relent on this.
One more question that I have to ask. Because we have different perspectives from Europe, from Africa, from African countries, what do you think and what is fought in Namibia about the war of Russia against Ukraine?
Wow. It's the first time I'm asked that question. The war of Russia, you see, look, first, I think I told you, or maybe I told somebody else, I'm a student of politics myself and trained at very advanced levels in politics, and I understand the geopolitics very well. You see, It's really a complex thing. For Russia, they see Ukraine as a part of their country. These are all Slavic people, including here, right? So they see the increasing encroachment of NATO on their border as a provocation. That said, I am convinced that there is no justification for aggression. I believe all people, and this is why in Namibia, for instance, we are saying we have a government. We recognize that there is a government in Windhoek. But as Democrats, we believe that the people remains the sovereigns. It is the people who are the ultimate or the final arbiters of their future. They must decide where they want it. So in Namibia, for instance, we're saying, yes, we voted you into government, but you never asked to speak to us or for us on the question of genocide. Why do you want to impose yourself? This is what we're telling the government in Windhoek to say. They have no right, even though they are a Namibian government, they have no right to speak for us on the question of genocide and reparation, because it was never part of their political program when they ran for election. If they want that, they must come and ask for a mandate, run a referendum. So in the same argument, if Russia feels that the people of Ukraine are a part of them, which is also, in my view, a medieval argument, because this is a country. I mean, if it was your province and people want to secede, run a referendum, a fair referendum that asks them where they want to belong. Now, if it's another country, to just invade another country on the basis that it should not have existed in the first place, I think that is gross violation. And so now the West, obviously, them having a beef with Russia, because they are, of course, they can all claim to be defenders of democracy, but some of them are not really doing very well with democracies in their own spaces. So that's what I'm saying, is a very complex thing. But all in all, I personally stand with Ukraine, because I don't believe anybody should just, sovereignty belongs to the people. The people of Ukraine, whether you feel they should not have been a country or not, they are a country and they belong to Ukraine. And nobody has the right to come and want to destroy a country simply because people want to rule themselves. Everybody has the right to rule themselves. So that's my personal opinion. And of course, in Namibia, the government is led by people, some of whom had close ties with the Soviet Union. They come from that era. So there is that nostalgia, there's that, you know, remembrance of those days. They want to hold on to it, of those days of the Soviet Union. But some of us who are students of politics, we remind them, because there is this stupid talk of, oh, Russia stood with us during the day of the liberation struggle. Some of us are asking, okay, if Russia stood with you, where was Ukraine? Because Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union as well. Then they also stood with you. So why don't you stand with them in this moment of really, really being subjected to an aggression? So it is a matter that has divided society, but I, under no circumstance, I don't excuse aggression at all. Yeah, absolutely, I don't. And so even though I don't agree with what I also see as the aggression of the Western countries, especially this expansion of NATO towards, you know, the East, which is really now on the, if had Ukraine joined, which increasingly it looks like it is going to join anyway at whatever time, it's going to be right on the border of Russia. I don't think it's a very smart thing, you know, to threaten somebody into feeling very insecure and that they must then start acting irrationally. That said, any aggression, the idea, they are bombing Kyiv. The idea of bombing the capital, organizing sham referendums in the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk or whatever, I can't even pronounce those, but I follow this war very keenly. First, it started with Crimea, you know? So, I don't know. I don't support that. I'm sorry. It might cost me your sympathy, but I don't support that. I don't support anybody going into any country. Look, Namibia, I told you, over Hero Land and Namaland, These were sovereign countries before the Germans came. We never agreed to the redrawing of our borders, but they were redrawn, and we have accepted that. Even now, in our quest for self-representation and all the things, nobody is questioning the integrity or, you know, the idea that Namibia is a country. We are saying the way we are administering that maybe needs to be changed. Maybe we are not very happy with the unitary system. Maybe we want the federation so that different people can also, you know, have a say in their own development in the different spaces where they live. But we are not really questioning the indivisibility of Namibia as a state. We have accepted that we are a state. So I am taken aback but that in the 21st century, there are still people who are calling for a return to borders of 100 years or whatever years, because apparently these people were the same. For me, that's just preposterous. It's crazy, you know. I don't support that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This was The Political Periscope. The podcast is released every Thursday at 7 p.m.